Sports. Wine. Life. This is the Macko and Cos podcast.
And welcome to the Macko and Cos podcast, pre-taped a little bit earlier. This will be out sometime close to New Year's-ish. Is Craig Berube still the head coach? Has Scotty Barnes turned it around? Who's the number one seed in the AFC and NFC? So many questions that we have none of the answers for, as it is now 12:14 on December 22nd. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Maddie. This is a retrospective.
Yeah.
Look at the year that was.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to do your show today, and we've got a whole bunch to get through. So do you want to just dive in with your first top five?
Yeah. First top five is top five people and top five sports figures, non-athletes.
Okay.
Number five, I'm putting John Cooper, the head coach of the Canadian men's Olympic hockey team.
Ooh, good one. Good one.
Number four, Rob Manfred. Baseball just had its best year, but there are the talks of labor issues and CBA are coming up. Also, just the amount of money the Dodgers spend, what can be done there. So that's my number four. Number three is Charles Barkley. Switched from TNT to ESPN. It feels like it's gone smooth, but we're going to learn a lot more just about what's that relationship like with Barkley and that crew and all the new producers at ESPN, because basketball really starts to ratchet up, especially after the NFL season is done. Number two, Mark Walter, who is the Dodgers owner and also the owner of the PWHL. This guy just keeps spending money and just makes the Dodgers the villain. And my number one top sports figure, non-athlete, Pablo Torre, and just all the work that guy has done, started with all the goofy stuff with Bill Belichick and his incredibly young girlfriend, to all things Clippers and Kawhi Leonard. So that's my top five sports figures, non-athletes.
That's a great list. And so what I'll do is I'll read mine, and then we can decide where there's overlap. Do we want to discuss it? And when we had different takes, do we want to discuss some of those? So number five for me was the head of MLSE, Keith Pelley. Number four was Stephen A. Smith, who signed a new deal with ESPN this year for $100 million.
Wow.
Number three was Hulk Hogan, who passed away earlier this year. Number two, Pablo Torre. Actually, the only spot where our lists overlap, then. I loved your list. And number one for me, actually, was Donald Trump, who I think inserted himself into the sports world in surprising ways and wasn't inserted into the sports world in ways that I think were even more surprising.
As I say all the time, I can't believe you're still talking about him. And I don't mean that in a bad way.
No,
he's in the
know.
News. You can't help it.
2025 was the year of Trump. He was across everything. Do you want to start there?
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to bring this up because particularly the Black Lives Matter protests happened, sports really took notice.
Mm-hmm.
Sports were a driving force in a lot of ways behind that conversation. And it was guys like LeBron, but really it was just every league right across the board. And Trump is doing so many things right now, and I'm kind of amazed by the way that sports hasn't picked up on any of this. We don't see any of the Latin players who are really vocal about ICE. There are any number of issues, and it kind of feels like sports, like the rest of the world, has just decided, we're going to ride this guy out. Or maybe quietly we agree, but more importantly, like, nobody knows how to protest this guy anymore. Sports feels, in a moment where the world is so incredibly political, I can't remember a time when sports was so apolitical.
It's an interesting, so this isn't even really, well, it's sort of about Trump. I wonder if part of it was everyone just got tired about how political sports became. And there was certainly cynicism, about, do you really mean it? Or are you doing this because you want to look good on social media? And I think a lot of people just look at sports as, can I just go here and just enjoy it without all the yelling and the fighting?
And my cynicism would say the bosses figured out that they're not going to make money from this.
That's the other part of it.
They were worried they were going to lose money if they didn't endorse Black Lives Matter. And then they realized that the public had kind of turned away from that sort of talking. And it was almost like everyone exhaled. And they're like, great, now we don't have to put our necks out there anymore because we won't look bad if we don't.
And then also I wonder how many athletes, I don't know this, I don't live in Miami, but going back to the Dan Lebatard show, he has inferred that a lot of times, a lot of the Hispanic and the different quarters in Florida are very right wing, and actually a lot of them vote for Donald Trump because they're very much more conservative in their social values. But also I wonder how many athletes quietly like Trump
Yes.
because of taxes. And because of money.
They're
And
rich.
because and the amount of their brands and all that kind of stuff. And that, you know, that they lose money if they're always on a pulpit talking against Trump. I wonder how much that's part of it.
Jordan got in a lot of trouble back in the day because he said Republicans buy shoes too.
Yep.
He's right. Republicans do buy shoes. And people would say, well, then you're putting money ahead of, you know, important social issues that you could really impact with your incredible platform. But we don't really talk about athletes' platforms anymore. We talk about their social platforms in the sense that they have marketing reach and that they have Q rating, which just means how well known somebody is. But we don't really, like, it's just weird to me. And the funny thing is, you know where we actually saw this happen for real? We saw this happen in hockey. We saw this happen around the Four Nations Cup, because when it was the Americans and the Canadians, and this was just on the heels of the tariff announcements and all the 51st state bullshit that was going on, people were going elbows up. That fucking exhibition was the center of my sports here.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember how crazy intense it was?
Yes.
That final game?
Oh, all of it. The first game, when all there was fighting early on.
Well, and the first, the game had three fights before it even started, really.
It was, yeah, oh yeah, it was, that was maybe the sporting event of the year.
Had to be.
Another thing I would add.
But Trump made it that way.
Yeah, oh, 100%. Absolutely, Trump elevated that entire spectacle. Another thing I would bring up is LeBron James and the amount of money that he and the NBA made from China. Mm-hmm. It makes it harder for your social, and again, you still should be able to do it, but like it hurts the messaging a little bit. Or when more companies, more leagues, more athletes are doing business in the Middle East with some of the same people that we know have put out orders to murder journalists. So well, what?
They're funding stadiums all over the place. There's a fund out there that's a billion strong to invest in stadium building.
Yeah. So I think that's also part of why there's less politics, because you want to be political and take a stand and I don't want to say shake your finger, because that means it makes it seem like I'm demeaning some of the messages. I'm not. But when you want to make a very principled stand, then and you're also taking money from other parts of the world that have far worse human rights issues than going on in North America, it just makes it more difficult. And I think that blunts some of the political message.
So you and I both are railing a little bit at the hypocrisy, but your hypocrisy is more based on individual choices and behavior. Mm-hmm. Whereas mine tends to be more systemic,
right,
and looks at kind of the class of it all and saying that the upper class have decided they don't need to pretend to care,
right,
because it won't make them money to pretend to care.
Yeah.
And if anything, caring will probably make them lose money. So it's actually a do not do. Don't do what Donnie Don't does and piss Trump off. So we both see hypocrisy. It's interesting, though, because you're more of an individual responsibility kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I tend to be more of a kind of a social systemic kind of guy.
And I think all the leagues, they knew they were losing money. They at some point, everything with Kaepernick and stuff, it just...
Well, Trump went out of his way to punish people.
Oh, yeah.
Like all the news networks mm-hmm. out there got their wrist slapped. He's suing the BBC for $10 billion. $10 billion, Matt. It's insane.
It is.
But it also puts a chill over everything. But to go back to it, the only where we really saw here in Canada where this was politics turned sports into something really, really important. Man, I don't know what the Olympics are going to look like now, but if it's Canada and the U.S. in the final of the Olympics, I'm not going to be able to take that because I can't lose to them.
I know.
Honestly, like, I will cry. I will cry if Canada loses to the States in the final.
As long as Austin Matthews doesn't score the game winner.
Honestly, if that happens, don't come back. Don't come back.
Hey, listen, you can have a great life in Italy. You can have a great life in Italy.
Well, talking about responsibility, the one that we had in common was Pablo Torre, who has a podcast. Pablo Torre, was it Finds
Things? Yeah, Pablo Torre finds out on the Metalark Media and is now partnered up with The Athletic as well.
Right, so... He really cracked a couple stories, and the biggest one was the aspiration scandal around Steve Ballmer and Kawhi Leonard, that money was being funneled to Kawhi through a cap circumvention means through this company that was kind of not even really a company. It was just really a way for Kawhi to get $30 million extra bucks that the NBA didn't see. And what was I find the story so interesting for two reasons. One, there's just not a lot of journalism in sports anymore. And sports used to be where the best writers were. And the best journalists, like the sports section at any newspaper for most of the 20th century was a murderer's row of outstanding talents. Less true now. But also how the NBA Their strategy is to really just try and shut up until this thing blows up.
Well, you wonder about how many other star players have gotten this treatment.
How many other teams?
How many owners have done it? Is this going to create a division between the super rich teams and the less rich ones? Because they can view this as another way that, you know, if you, the super billionaires can have an advantage. My main takeaway, what I'm rooting for, I want Pablo Torre to get incredibly wealthy. I want Pablo Torre
to find sell out and stop doing this shit.
That's right. You shut up now. If this works, if there's a way where journalism can get money and it can fund other journalistic wings, I would be thrilled for that. I would be thrilled to find more ways where real journalism takes work, it takes time, it takes money, and there's less and less of it. If they can create a model where it does, then I love it. Then, you know, people that think like Pablo can go do it. People that are right-wing and want to expose other hypocrisies and do the investing. But if you're just paying journalists, that's the main thing I'm rooting for.
I love that. And I think about you and your dad's legacy of sports writing. Like, people may not know this about you, but you grew up in the home of someone who's a highly respected sports, like when he covered, he's in the Horse Racing Hall of Fame.
Right? That's right. Yes.
You know, for covering that. Actually, I love the story about your dad, about how he was the official scorer for Robbie Alomar.
No, it was Paul Molitor.
Okay.
It was Paul Molitor, and it was iffy whether or not it was a 3-run triple or not. And my dad, you know, it was close enough. My dad gave him the triple. I forget whoever the pitch, and he wasn't with the Jays. He was with another team. And eventually, like, Paul signed a baseball for my dad and said, you know,
thanks for the triple.
Thanks for the triple. But yeah, there was always funny stories of players would call my dad at home going, could you relook at that? Maybe that wasn't an error. Maybe it was an error, depending if it was a pitcher or if it was a hitter that was yammering with him.
Okay, so we got top five non-athletes going here. You mentioned Rob Manfred and I didn't. Mm-hmm. And your point that you started to make was that baseball hasn't had a more successful on-field product than this year in recent memory. I don't know that any sport has had a year like this in the field of play. What do they do next? Like, can you even capitalize on something like that anymore?
What they need to do is they got to find a way not to have a lockout, because they have all the momentum. And it's funny, a bunch of years ago, Rob Manfred was the worst commissioner, where he was talking about, you know, the World Series. Well, it's just a hunk of metal, the trophy. And that just, he seems so to touch, mm-hmm. but he's helped to shepherd in rule changes. And the biggest one, of course, being the pitch clock, and the games are faster, more dynamic, and doing all these things. And so he's done a good job. But if they do go on strike, and if we do lose a year or half a year, and, you know, what's to be done with teams like the Dodgers, but also then what's to be done with the cheap teams that don't spend money? I hate what the Dodgers are doing, because to me, it makes sports less compelling when, hey, did you hear about the team that won? Oh, yeah, they had all the players. Okay, that's not a great story. But then at the same point, you need to punish the Pittsburghs and Cincinnati's of the world that aren't spending nearly enough money as well. So there is challenges. And I just wonder how does he get through the next year?
I want to talk a bit, when you talk about people who are running stuff, how do you get through the next year? And I want to bounce it back to Keith Pelley.
Yeah.
We have talked a lot about him on the pod. You and I know him personally. He was really a mentor to both of us when we were all at TSN. You know, I don't know, like, we're pre-recording this, so we're not 100% sure who's still on the team at this point.
Is Ruby there? Is Trey living there? Who knows who's there?
But I think one thing that's for sure is that a lot of smart people have gone to MLSE. Brian Burke, Randy Carlyle, Wilson, Ron Wilson, thank you. You know, just people who came there with great reputations and have left with those reputations in tatters.
Yes.
The Leafs are a bit like the Overlook Hotel for people's reputations. Like, it's fucking haunted and nobody here gets out alive. If you're Pelly, like, what do? You've got a team that people hate, a team that's underperforming. People are now finally starting to not go to the games. And, you know, Toronto wants to love its team, its hockey team, and it doesn't. It just doesn't. So what do?
It's the hardest thing right now in Toronto sports is the Maple Leafs, because they are under the biggest microscope, because the Raptors are more lovable, because they won the championship in 2019. You can still dine off of that. And in the answer, like, I don't know how you make him more lovable, because Matthews, you are in awe at his skill when he's performing, and he isn't.
If he's still a Leaf.
If he's still a Maple Leaf when this is out. But he was never lovable. For whatever reason, just didn't have that secret sauce.
I think a lot about Doug Gilmore, whom people loved. Like, Wendell Clark was loved. Wendell Clark wasn't necessarily the most, you know, effusive guy. But the way he played, people loved that about him. He was tough as nails, Kellington, Saskatchewan, fight anybody, fight guys who were bigger than him. He was an easy player to love. Matt Sundin wasn't loved for a long time. But the team, you know, was always good under his auspices.
Heroic moments when they were the underdog, right, beating Ottawa a bunch of years.
His gift was so great. He was the most talented Leaf previous to Austin Matthews. But he also proved it, right? Like, when push came to shove, he showed up in big moments. And Matthews, to this point, hasn't done that. You know, I think I've talked about this on the pod before, but Matthews, like, I know this guy, I met him in LA, and he worked on the Amazon series that covered the Leafs. And he said, the thing about Matthews is he's a really good guy, but he's a bit aloof. Like, he's not really like your average hockey player. And I kind of like that about him, but it puts him in a tough spot, because sometimes you just want him to be Doug Gilmore, who's like the ultimate hockey player, but he's kind of not like that.
No, there were moments in the playoffs where, like, players, I think it was Montreal, was like ragdolling him, and Matthews was laughing because he was bigger than this guy, mm-hmm, and he wasn't getting hurt, and he's just kind of laughing at him. And I, at first, I'm like, oh, good for you. That's a great sign of you're telling the other guy, fuck off. You don't impact me at all. But there's also a thing that with Matthews, you've never seen that definitive visual moment of toughness, of just coming through. And the thing is, he's still one of the leaders in block shots. That takes a lot of bravery. But it's a weird thing to try to discuss toughness without assigning it to character flaws. But there hasn't been that moment that got us to fall in love with Matthews.
But here's the reality. No matter how much we want to make hockey about goals and statistics and Corsi, it's a tough game.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows this. And if you're not tough in this game, there's only so great you can be. Nobody whom we consider great wasn't tough. Gretzky, you know, he had a kind of a mental toughness about him. You know, Mario wasn't slugging out there, but Mario, you know, played through cancer, right? Like, Mario was plenty tough. Even, like people weren't sure what to make of Sundin, but Sundin playing hurt convinced people he's a hockey player. And I don't know that this is such a bad thing. People want to paint this as a Neanderthal way of looking at sports, but it's a physical sport. Toughness is part of it. You know, we love Sweet Pea Whitaker for his gift and his skill as a boxer. It's defensively, he might be, you know, one of the greatest defensive boxers who ever lived. But he's not in love the way, like, an Arturo Gatti is, or somebody, or even like Ali, who learned how to get through wars. We want to see people who do tough things be tough. It's part of the agenda.
Yeah, there hasn't been the heroic moment. And sports is entertainment. Sports is about telling stories. And again, with Matthews, and I can say the same thing about Nylander. I can say the same thing about Morgan Rielly. You know, for the most part, these guys in their careers here, they haven't had that moment that just galvanized everyone together. And they're incredibly skilled, talented people. They all stick around. They're going to have all the records. They're going to have all the records, but they're not going to have your heart.
The numbers don't matter.
Yeah.
In the men, there's only two things that matter. One is the ultimate championship,
uh-huh,
and then also the moments along the way. You know, this is actually a good way to switch over to Toronto athletes, top five Toronto athletes of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Do this quick and then come back and do another pod around stories of the year. Let me give you my list of...
Oh, this will be our last one. It's 12:30. It's going to take me half an hour or so to get into the office for a 2 o'clock okay show.
So here's my top five Toronto athletes. You ready?
Yeah.
Starting at five, going to one.
Yeah.
Troy Savage.
Mm-hmm.
Number four, and this is a bit of a cheat because he's kind of a golden horseshoe guy, really, but Shea Gilgeous-Alexander.
Yep.
He's not really Toronto, but we'll claim him. Number three, Mitch Marner. Number two, Austin Matthews. And number one, of course, Vladdy Guerrero.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a list you want to throw out there, or do you want to go off of mine?
I want to go off of yours. I think the most remarkable thing is where we were a year ago with Vlad versus where we are now.
Yeah.
You know, and...
So we'll start right at the top.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean...
He had one of the great World Series of...
The entire playoff run.
Honestly, like, in the entire history of the sport, he's been as good. That run was as good as anybody who ever played.
And also, not to belabor an easy point, so I'll make it quick. He had a good regular season, not a great one. He had a good, good to very good, however you want to, whatever adjective you want to use. And then what did he do in the playoffs? He elevated all of it.
And elevated the team with him, because it wasn't just that he was up there delivering knocks. He was the cheerleader for the team. He raised everybody's game in the dressing room when they were down. He refused to be down. It's funny because you describe Vladdy's year. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we all know they were good. He had a good year, but he's being paid like he's a great player.
Yeah.
Austin Matthews, he's having a good year, but he's being paid like he's a great player. When the playoffs start, one choked, Matthews. The other took off like a rocket and strapped the entire country to his back and said, let's go. Certainly the team went with him. They can't have that run without, you know, half a dozen guys who all contributed. But Vladdy felt like the driving force.
Yeah. The other one, please, Trey Savage, don't ever get hurt. Don't be, you know, the pitcher that's got crazy talent and does wild things and strikes out everyone. And then we find out it's arm soreness. Oh, he's on the IL. Oh, no. He's getting Tommy John.
But it was such a crazy debut.
It was.
That was the first moment, like that first start against the Yankees was the moment where you go, is something magical going on? Like, so many magical things happened. It was a bit like the Indiana Pacers in a way during their run in the NBA, where it was just, how many times can this team do something that I feel like I haven't seen before? Like, Savage gets out there, and they're talking about this being one of the most, you know, incomparable debuts in MLB history. And that was one of four or five different things.
Yeah.
I just felt like I've never seen this before.
It was such a great run. It's why.
It also gave us hope.
It did.
Right? Like, it was sort of like if Easton Cowan got called up and all of a sudden he was Steve Eiserman.
Yeah. Because he's young hope and you got him here for ages and it feels like that should be, fingers crossed, an anchor for the team.
I want to talk a little bit about Mitch before we move on to some other stuff.
Yeah.
Because in a lot of ways, the Leafs and the way we look at the Leafs, it was like, it's probably Matthews' story, but really the way Mitch was handled feels kind of like how we got here. And because it ended, that feels like the end of the story, really. Like, we want it to keep going. We want there to be a last act. We want the Leafs to find something and, you know, do better than they ever did, or at least as well as they did. But the truth is, without Mitch there, how much of this is on ice stuff? I don't know. But just even how that whole thing was handled in the business sense, that feels like the end of the Leafs window. And when Mitch left, it was like hockey's way of saying, guys, this is over. I don't know how much we were ready to hear that message, but it's like he saw something and he's like, I can't stay here. And then now the fans are catching up to it.
And also, they didn't get anything for him. There's no assets. There's no building blocks to replace it. And the funny thing is everyone's like, everyone in the media, they were so happy to see him go, and they didn't realize how good he was. I'm like, none of that's true. Everyone in the media said the same thing. He's incredible in the regular season. He's elite. The reason, you know, everyone just said that something had to change. And the reason why it was Marner was because his contract was up. If Marner was under contract for the next 5 years and it was Nylander, then it would have been Nylander that would have gone. I mean, it was just something with the roster construction, with all the forwards that kind of play a very similar style. It just didn't work in the playoffs.
Let me do a quick little, I don't know how quick it can be, but we don't have a ton of time. And I want to do stories of the year.
Yeah.
I'll go just some of the ones that almost made it. Kendrick Lamar's halftime show. The Philadelphia Eagles won, but really, Kendrick Lamar won, and Drake lost that thing.
Yes.
The PWHL expands to Vancouver and Seattle. I actually think watching women's sports take hold, it's really interesting. People are getting pretty tired of how corporate the rest of the sports world has gotten. Could be the new grassroots. Canelo and Terrence Crawford, just a great fight, and maybe the last great fight we're ever going to see that feels like it was part of boxing history the way we knew it. Okay, ready? Here we go. The Luka trade. At number five. Number four, Netflix airs the WWE for the first time on January 6th. Number three, the Shohei Ohtani perfect game, game four of the NLCS against the Brewers, three home runs and 10 strikeouts. We'll never see that again. Game seven with the Leafs. And number one is game seven with the Jays. Anywhere you want to dive in? Those are my top five stories of the year.
Not the top two. I can tell you. I mean, the Leafs won. They got embarrassed. They got embarrassed in game five. They got embarrassed in game seven. And that might have, like, that was the moment when you, like, there's 100 moments when you knew. But everyone's like, well, you know, they took the Stanley Cup champs to a game seven, did they? I remember the Raptors pushed, you know, Cleveland and LeBron like six games. But all the four wins were by a ton. And the two times that LeBron lost, they were single-digit losses.
In game seven of the NBA, the Pacers wound up losing to the Oklahoma City Thunder. But Tyrese Halliburton went down with his ACL injury. And the game was never close. But nobody looked at that and said, wow, the Pacers, that leaves a bad taste in my mouth. If anything, it was like, that was incredible. And it almost happened. They pushed it to seven. It never should have gone there. They had miraculous play along the way, like through their whole run. And their greatest player went down in the end and couldn't finish the game. OKC kicked their asses. They won decisively. But nobody looked at that and said, Indiana left me feeling shortchanged. When the Leafs lost to Florida, and they lost bad in game five, and they lost again in game seven, we've seen that again. Everybody looked at that and said, it's not just that you lost. It's just that when push came to shove, you were so shovable. Why are you so shovable time and time again? There's nothing in sports that we hate more than underperforming.
And that's
except
a big
for one thing, not showing up.
Oh, yeah. And they both underperformed and they didn't show up. This might sound cruel. At some point in the hockey playoffs, you got to be a bully.
Yeah.
Who on the Maple Leafs is a bully?
Well, because it's a meritocracy. And at some point, you have to throw your weight around. You have to. The team that wins is the team that dominates the other side. That's it.
And that's why change had to happen. You know, that's why.
I don't think enough change happened. And we're learning that now.
We are learning that now.
I also want to talk about Netflix and the WWE a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it may seem like a weird story. But, you know, I was thinking about you the other day because YouTube signed the rights to the Academy Awards. And that feels like the thing that I hate about it is the Academy Awards was all about glamour. And there's nothing less glamorous than watching it on my laptop on YouTube. It just feels like such a letdown. However, what it's really about is eyeballs. And that's where the Academy Awards are like. That's where the eyeballs are. If you're going to advertise it, would you rather advertise it on ABC or on YouTube?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right? But the same point being, when Netflix signed WWE, I thought both sides here are getting something really well. You get the incredible storytelling machine and the soap opera of WWE and all those young male eyeballs. But Netflix also, like, is giving WWE proximity to where the people really are. And they kind of dipped their toe in for years. I don't think they've dipped their toe in anymore. They just bought, like, Warner Brothers, at least that's the time we're taping. They're waiting for that deal to be ratified. It's not going to be on TV anymore, man. It's just another sign that is just over.
Yeah, and you would...
Like, all of it.
Oh, yeah.
The NFL, the NBA, all of it. Like,
everything's going to be fractured. The big concern is, how much harder is it going to be to find what we want to watch, and how much more money is it going to be? It comes down to that. Ease of access, and what is it going to do on my wallet?
One of the best things about sports our whole lives is that it didn't cost money to watch the game. I mean, it does in the sense that you have a cable package, but nobody really carved it out. And then over the years, that started to happen. Like, now you see it getting bundled with everything, and now there's a la carte viewing. And you wait and see. Like, going to the games now is next to impossible. It's going to be expensive to watch sports in 10 years. We don't think of it as expensive. It's going to be expensive.
It's a slow burn. Oh, there's one NFL game on Amazon. Oh, there's four Leaf games are on Paramount or wherever, right. You know, and then it starts to grow. And here's the question. Will there be a day where the Super Bowl is pay-per-view?
Right.
That now, we talk about the public maybe not enough of uprising against Trump. You want to piss off everyone? Put the Super Bowl on pay-per-view.
But think about it. People get used to this stuff really quickly.
They do.
The Grey Cup used to be on the CBC, and then it went to TSN.
I hope that there's always, you know, and maybe it can't. Maybe it's just wishing for a time gone by.
It's gone by.
I know. You turn on CBS, and there's the game.
Right.
You know, you turn on CBS, and I'm going to get a good AFC
game. It actually felt easier to participate with it because you didn't have to go out of your way.
Mm-hmm.
To order it and pay for it. It didn't feel like a commodity the way everything else is a commodity. It It wasn't like going to the movies where you had to put your $10 down and now 20 or whatever. You know, it was there. It was there in your home. We allowed it to become part of our lives because there was no barrier to entry. But more and more people are like, barrier to entry? That's where I'm going to make my money. Let's get that barrier up.
Going back to what we talked about the PWHL and other leagues and stuff, we don't have a lot of time left, but some of my Toronto sports stories.
Yeah.
One, the Toronto Tempo.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see, you know, it'll take a while. Any new league, any new team, but how they are woven into the Toronto sports tapestry, the new WNBA team. And the other one, this is a smaller one, but I'm just curious about this. World Cup traffic in Toronto.
Yeah, that's a huge one. I got that down, actually.
Like, they can't do an LRT. You can run faster than the LRT on Finch. No one knows if Eglinton is... Oh, here's a prediction, Bob. This podcast is coming out a week or so later. The Eglinton LRT will not be running when this episode comes out. There is a prediction by me that I feel very good about.
Okay, so this is really interesting. Let's go back to the PWHL for a moment. Mm-hmm. I do think that there's going to be room for some grassroots sports to come up because and affordability is going to be the thing. It has to feel legit. And one of the tricky things about stuff in Toronto, like the CFL, is it feels like a sport that should be better, but it isn't. We know that the CFL is not the best football that we can watch. It's a bit like going to watch junior hockey. Yes, I get it. They're all great athletes. But, you know, I want the top flight thing, right? But women's sports is different, right? Because we understand that to be just a separate category. I see this as so potentially interesting in terms of rebuilding a sports cultural infrastructure. If they play it wrong, they're going to turn it into just a slightly cheaper version of going to see the Leafs.
Right.
If they play it right, it's going to feel more like NASCAR or UFC, where I don't just follow a sport. I'm the kind of person who follows this sport.
I like UFC and NASCAR. That's perfect because massively successful, massively popular. They might not be as big as college football, the NBA, or the NFL.
They're huge.
But my point is, who cares?
Yeah.
They're massive. They're huge. They make lots of money. Here's what I want. For the Toronto Tempo or the PWHL. Mm-hmm. I want, how long does it take for the player's average salary is at a point where they can afford to buy a condo next to where they play the game?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Like, it has to become sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And part of sustainable is that good players get paid enough that they can concentrate on this and have some kind of perks for doing it. I'm with you there. And you know, I've got a friend who's an investor in the new Women's Northern Super League, right, for soccer. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him a lot about how the team, like, I would love to see it be like St. Pauli. And St. Pauli is like a Division II team in Hamburg, Germany. But it's like almost like, imagine like the Green Bay Packers in the sense that the community kind of owns it. But you see people walking around in St. Pauli shirts. And it's the same way in Toronto. You see people who live in Parkdale wearing Parkdale shirts. We need to get a little territorial and we need to support the underdog. And Toronto is an underdog city. That's the thing that's so funny. The best part of this city is not the one that's like Bay Street at the Scotiabank. It's the one that loves the scrap. And I feel like these teams can be that.
Well, you get more of a sense of ownership. It doesn't just feel like just a corporate obligation.
100%. You know, as I said to somebody the other day, cheering for the Leafs right now is like cheering for Loblaws. There's no joy in it, really. And it's like, oh, man, I hope this incredibly wealthy thing that fucks me over all the time gets richer. That would be great. And then they won't translate any of those riches to me. I want to see something built grassroots in this city. This city desperately needs it. It needs it. Our cultural life is getting decimated. Our political life is feeling more and more distant and unsatisfying. Toronto is a city of neighborhoods. Toronto is a city of communities. And I want sports to elevate that the way it always has. And it's not going to come from the guy's side because honestly, you're cheering for Scotiabank at that point. It's got to come from the grassroots.
Yeah. I agreed. Now, I think there's a little bit of that with the Blue Jays, because at least for the 81 home games, it's a little bit cheaper to go to. But no, absolutely.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Baseball has the chance to be the people's sport, mm-hmm. and it kind of was when we were growing up. Although, honestly, going to Maple Leaf Gardens wasn't crazy expensive. I got to go, and we were lower middle class.
I did a thing on that, looking at how unlikable the Leafs are. And in 92, 93, you could get a ticket for $20.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, and you could go and see a concert for about the same amount of money, and that was about 4 or 5 hours worth of pay if you were a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and exactly. Now it's...
Now 4 or 5 hours worth of pay is about 50, 60 bucks, and the ticket is 400.
What's your New Year's resolution? You got any New Year's as we end this?
I don't make resolutions.
Smart.
I do something called Fortnite of Concentration, where I choose something for 2 weeks and do it real hard. And if I like it, I stick with it. And if I don't, I just swap in something new. It's the Fortnite of Resolve.
I love it.
2 weeks at a time. You?
I'm thinking of starting smoking.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that's a good one.
Really trying to get, no, kidding. No, I don't really have any New Year's resolutions. Just all I root for is, can the next year at least be hopefully as good as the last?
I also resolve to do better at picking up when you give me an exit line.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.